Picture this. You have a 10 a.m. flight to catch, but you oversleep, and your GPS says ground traffic is insurmountable. You realize your taxi is never going to be able to get you to the airport on time. What if you had another alternative to choose from on that app, hailing an air taxi? Imagine an aircraft that's intended for shorter distances of travel than the traditional commercial aircraft we're accustomed to. But wait, it gets better. Imagine that the cost is comparable to ground transportation choices. Well, that's been touted as science fiction for as long as we can remember, but it will soon be reality. Flying taxis won't only be for the Jetsons. Hello and welcome to part two of my conversation with founder and CEO of Airspace Experience Technologies, John Riminelli. Airspace Experience Technology, also known as ASX, specializes in the development of eVTOL aircraft, electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, with the goal being to create a versatile aircraft that's low in emissions, affordable, and can operate in both public and private sectors. In our last episode, John broke down what an air taxi is and what the costs are to operate one, as well as the technology behind them. In this episode, John and I continue our discussion on air taxis, delving into issues such as safety, traffic management, and infrastructure. We also take a closer look at ASX's Sigma 6 and the lessons learned from previous iterations of this aircraft. Join me, Ed Bernardin, on this episode of The Future Car as we continue to take to new heights. John, welcome to The Future Car Podcast. Key to safety is air traffic control. When traditional aircraft are flying from city to city, they try and keep the airplane spaced, you know, so they don't run into each other. However, now you're probably going to have a lot of these urban air vehicles moving around within a city, moving towards airports where there's traditional aircraft landing and taking off. What has to be done to the air traffic control system so that now it can start to handle, which is a whole new type of aircraft, a whole significant increase in number of aircraft and also in a more tightly spaced area? Is something being done to make sure that these things are going to be safe?
Traffic management is a big issue, right? Because when you're talking about autonomous systems on the ground, on the air, the question is, how do you constrain them? How do you organize them in the national airspace system? On the ground, we have curbs and intersections and stop signs and traffic lights, which our automation is designed to see. Those are its rules, but there's no rules in the air. So what we've done is we've actually developed a new approach to traffic management using short-range wireless communication, which is connected vehicle technology, where we broadcast the standards for, let's call it, arrivals, departures, authentication of traffic, speed, direction, interchanges. So we're actually in the middle of a proposal right now with the U.S. Department of Transportation to demonstrate our own traffic management system right here in Detroit. We've got a proof of concept vehicle that is ready to go into the air probably in coming weeks. You know, I go back to harvesting automotive technology. We've thought very hard about how to manage high velocity, high volume automotive traffic using connected vehicle architecture. I took that same architecture and I said, hey, why are we trying to reinvent something new for air traffic? Our aircraft are going to be operating at about 1,000 to 3,000 feet above the ground. We want to sequence and separate traffic. We want to broadcast standards. Well, we already have a system to do that on the ground. So we've pitched that to USDOT. Now NASA and the FAA are saying, oh, this is interesting. We can actually have an active traffic management system. We have vehicle-to-vehicle communication, collision avoidance. So I think we're heading in the right direction. We hope to be able to have that thing deployed here within the next 6 months here in Metro Detroit. We're working with some very large companies to demonstrate that. So you've got the aircraft system because you have autonomous aircraft. They're going to want to know where they can go and where they can't go. And you really have to have cities and communities broadcasting that. Otherwise, there's going to be no coordination, no system for organizing traffic. So that's the approach that we're taking, and it seems to be picking up traction.
Now, in order to do this, you'd have to cooperate with the other urban air vehicle companies. So you all accept the same protocol and methodology to communicate.
It's low cost is the good news. It's a low cost system. It already exists. It's like technology readiness level of like 9, 10. Let's call it a 9. And it already exists. There are vehicle and there are hardware manufacturers that already have this stuff in stock, no waiting. On the ground, it's been a bit of a challenge to deploy it because, you know, the government has pretty much made communities responsible for upgrading their roadways with wireless infrastructure. And, you know, everybody complains about not having enough money for the roads. Well, they don't have enough money for the roads. They don't have enough money for wireless infrastructure. But now that we make it a dual purpose system, right, it's a dual use technology, it's now infrastructure that the government and local communities can now see the value in. It's not just a single purpose infrastructure. It's not just for cars. It's for aircraft and ground vehicles.
Well, leveraging what's going on the ground for connected vehicles makes a lot of sense. Just take the protocols and take it into the air. But it is three dimensions and not two. I think about those Star Wars movies where you see the perfectly aligned lines of cars just flying all perfectly aligned. When you bring that third dimension in, it must create some new problems that aren't addressed on the ground. Are you addressing those somehow?
The short-range wireless communication system basically allows a vehicle to establish separation standards. You can't get any closer to me than X, Y, and Z. So when you're platooning vehicles in and out of an urban center, they can be sort of caravaned in with a precision. It's almost like you have adaptive cruise control on the ground. It's like having adaptive cruise control in the air, right? When my vehicle and other vehicles are able to compete with each other. So that is a big feature, an important feature of the short-range wireless. If we've demonstrated platooning, we can sequence and separate traffic autonomously. That's what you're going to need if we're going to see a high volume and a high density of these vehicles going in and out of urban centers.
So do you think it will be somewhat like that? Like here's a corridor, or maybe like a tube in the air. And when you're going one direction, it's this way. When the other direction, it's a different tube, shall we say, or corridor they have to fly through?
Yeah. So you essentially have levels of mobility. So you have, you know, from 0 to 400 feet is really where the small unmanned systems traffic will operate. And at 100 feet, it'll be low speed. 200 feet, it'll be slightly higher speed. You know, 3 to 400 feet will be your high speed lane. And then you'll have this, you know, the larger electric VTOLs and helicopters transitioning through that space. So they are going to segment the airspace, this low altitude aircraft infrastructure, if you will. So it's all heading in the right direction. It's just the government doesn't really want to say, this is the standard, this is what we're going to do. They kind of want industry to do that. They want industry to sort of decide what the final infrastructure should look like. They're finally now picking up on the approach that we've been proposing because it's already in existence from a technology readiness level. So that piece is actually ready.
Is there a lot of cooperation and a lot of communication between the different manufacturers of urban air vehicles to move this forward?
There isn't. I'd like there to be. You know, the Vertical Flight Society does a great job of serving as a, you know, an industry consortium to advance mobility and create working groups to solve problems. But I think in order for this to really be successful, that we need to build a standard class of vehicles and increase the volume of production of those components to the point where we're able to get high reliability data to support safety, right? Because that's a number one priority, right? Is making sure that people in the air and on the ground are safe. And whenever we can standardize hardware, software, technology, the better, right? Because there's less opportunity for anomalies, right? When you have standards in the architecture, in my view.
Do you think when this service is finally available, there's going to be some hesitancy to jump into an urban air vehicle?
Surprisingly, a lot of people are very, you know, anxious to get in these things. They just, I think the human nature is that we all like the idea of flying. A lot of people do. I get asked all the time, can I come down and take a ride? No, not yet. Not yet. When my team says it's safe, then I can fly. But until then, you know, I'm grounded like the rest of you.
I guess if we see you flying, then we know it's got to be safe. And that probably gets us to the point where we say, well, if he's flying in it, I'll give it a try.
The distributed electric propulsion adds that, you know, additional level of redundancy, right? You know, that was the whole concept behind distributed electric propulsion. We distribute the load across a variety, a plurality of rotors and motors so that if one fails or two fails, we can arrest the descent and land safely.
Well, you founded the company in 2017, ASX, and to arrive at your current vehicle, the Sigma 6, you went through 6 iterations. Can you give us a little bit of an idea what those iterations were like and what you learned along the way?
For me, it's always been about finding a solution that was flexible. And we started off with a modular system. We pitched it to Uber. They're like, looks great. We love it. Lose the modularity. Add a tail so we have some dynamic stability in the event of a system failure. So we've gone through a number of, I think we built 2 10th scales, and then we went to third scales, and we went to, or fifth scales, and then third scales, and then half scale, and then full scale. And they improved with every iteration, right? So the performance improved, L over D performance, the range, the safety. So this was just sort of the culmination of the last 6 vehicles that we built. And we're still, you know, having built this full-scale vehicle, now we're ready to build the next block 1 and employ all the lessons learned on block 0, right? So it's all about just continuously improving.
Has the aircraft you have now, the one I saw at the Detroit show, has it flown? Not necessarily that particular one, but one of that design.
That has flown very briefly. You know, we started flight tuning and testing in August of this year. We had the show, obviously, in September, so we had to knock it down the first week of September. But we were able to get it. We got it off the ground about a foot. Unfortunately, we were limited to keeping it low because we didn't get all of our batteries from our supplier. I mean, the supply chain has been a real problem for us on the battery front. Still a problem. We have 1/6 of the available battery that we need to exercise the machine. So when you have 1/6 of the battery, you're asking for consequences. You know, you can melt that battery down and create thermal excursions, which we don't want to do. So we're really limited in what we can do. We hope to have the rest of the batteries in January, but it could be as long as June.
Once you have your batteries, how long after that would you think before you're going to sit there and pilot it on a typical run, say, of, I don't know what you mean, several miles?
You know what? It's very progressive, Edward. I mean, we're in the risk management business. We don't, you know, we take it one step at a time. So I know that by midsummer, we're supposed to be into partial transition. I would love to be in full transition, but, you know, I listen to my team and the team says we're going to make decisions when we complete technical milestones, right? As we can complete each angle of incidence through transition, we're going to make a determination, right? But I would like to be in transition by next year. I would love that. I hope that that's the case. But, you know, it really is up in the air.
Can you tell us a little bit about the range and the amount of cargo you can carry and how those interrelate to what your vehicle is going to be able to do?
Well, so purely electric with 2,000 pounds with, let's call it, future battery. By the time we're certified, we're looking at about 65 miles with 2,000 pounds and about 150 miles pure electric with 1,000 pounds. And if we go hybrid, you know, we can go around 450 miles with 2,000 pounds, and we can do about 700 to 900 miles with 1,000 pounds. you know, the range really is going to be determined by how much you want to move and what you know, propulsion system, what source of energy you have on board.
I suppose the since you have a pod, depending on what's in the pod, if it's a defense application or a first responder, will impact that depending on the weight of the pod and what's inside of it. Connecting it up in just a couple of minutes, especially if you're going to start to work with automotive companies or maybe even other urban air vehicle companies, you have to standardize that interface some way.
So the vision is for a multimodal transportation system that standardizes a container. It standardizes the interface to the aircraft, the container, and the ground vehicle. There's one automotive company that we are working with actively at this moment to develop an interface. We're not speaking publicly about it just yet, but we are working hand-in-hand with another automotive OEM to develop that standard interface.
Do you think over time that there'll be other, I don't know if you want to call them pod-type air vehicles like this, that it'll just become somewhat commonplace rather than purpose-built? I guess that's a trade-off, right? This pod approach versus a purpose-built.
So if we were able to create the ultimate mobility system, right, we'd have a container that could be driven, it could be flown, it could be put on a rail car, it could be put on a marine vessel. So that way we maximize the opportunity for mobility. There's only going to be so much space on the ground for ground vehicles. Now, we have a lot more capacity in the air to manage traffic than we do on the ground. But if we had the ability to harmonize mobility and truly share mobility between air and ground vehicles and have a variety of OEMs participate in the aircraft, in the container, in the ground vehicle, you end up with a whole new system for transportation that is ultimately more efficient, you know, especially now with batteries being scarce. You know, now we can share energy between ground and air transport systems by virtue of the container. That problem's not going to go away. I mean, there is only a finite amount of resources in the world that are available. And I think if we're going to truly share mobility, that we've got to really grow this concept of multimodal transportation. And that's what we're hoping to demonstrate with our machine and invite other industry players to participate.
Inherently, though, when you try and build something that can do many tasks versus purpose-built, there can be a loss in efficiency. And I think you mentioned that earlier, that might not be as aerodynamic. So I would assume that fundamental to your business approach is that the benefits and flexibility outweigh somewhat the efficiency.
Yeah, there's always a cost, right, to a configuration. There's always a trade-off. So we may not be optimized for aerodynamics, but we're optimized for mobility, flexibility, which allows us to do more jobs, you know, with a single platform.
You mentioned hybrid mode. I suppose that's to help you in those times when you have the bigger cargo or you want to go a little bit further. Is that a direct drive type thing, or is it to generate, to recharge the batteries?
Either or our configurations. A series hybrid is certainly something that we are actively looking at. And then there is a direct drive hybrid where we basically are using a turbo generator to provide, you know, energy to our electric motors. There may be some, you know, storage capacity on board, if you will, purely as a reserve and not necessarily as a primary source of energy.
You mentioned being quiet. So I would think that keeping that noise down relative to helicopters, one of the big advantages here. So the hybrid mode is probably for those longer distance traveling, not so much for the short hops between the city. You have a unique technology that I think you're patenting that actually makes it quieter, makes the rotors quieter when they're operating. What can you tell us about that?
Well, so low noise was a really high priority for us. I mean, I'd say number one, number two is low noise, because the last thing we want to do is create all this noise in the air. It's annoying. I don't like it. And I know everybody else doesn't like it. So we started off with a low noise requirement, which was basically a tip speed, a rotor tip speed, which translates into an RPM and a rotor size. So we really optimize the rotor size, speed, to maximize low noise.
Is there a trade-off in efficiency there?
Well, actually, the larger the rotor, the higher the efficiency. So we actually use, you know, 6 very large rotors. So the efficiency actually goes up with the rotor size. So the trade-off is, you know, on the motors, you know, motors like higher RPMs from an efficiency standpoint. So there are fewer motor options that are direct drive, low RPM like that.
I do want to ask you about your assembly. You talk about in final assembly how you can snap it together. I start thinking, oh, wow, it's like almost like a Lego aircraft, full-size Lego aircraft. What do you mean by snapping together?
We designed this thing for high, you know, for manufacturability, right? So the main thing we wanted to be able to do is produce these things at scale very quickly so that they could effectively snap together, right? Which means that we're employing a lot of high run rate composite techniques that have low cycle times, high pressure resin transfer molding or pultrusions. These are the primary methods that we're using to, you know, produce the aerostructure at scale and at speed. We wanted to design this thing with the fewest number of moving parts. So there's very few actuators. We don't have tilt rotors. We have a tilt wing. So a lot of our competitors have 6 to 12 rotors that they have to tilt. We don't tilt. We stabilize a fuselage to the wing. We don't actually tilt rotors. So we designed it so that it can be quickly manufactured and assembled and be highly, should I say, serviceable. Right, because serviceability is very important. These were part of the requirements that we set for ourselves, you know, during the design process.
Let's think a little bit about where this is all headed. You said if all goes well, 2, 3, 4 years here, we'll start to see these actually going into service, possibly, if all goes well.
Maybe not ours, but there are market leaders like Joby that are doing a great job, and they're sort of, you know, they've gotten their 135 certification. They're well on their way to getting certification. So they're going to demonstrate this capability early on. You know, we're looking forward to following.
So tell me, let's look 10 years into the future, and then let's take a big step after that. And let's go to, say, the year 2050, when all this autonomous cars, urban air vehicles, autonomous mode, pilot assisted modes, whatever it might be, micromobility, the cities have embraced it, and the cities are redesigned to take advantage of this. What do you think we'll see in 10 years? And then what do you think we'll see in, let's call it 30 years?
Well, in 10 years, you're going to see, I would say, hockey stick growth in urban air mobility. We're going to see it in all major cities around the country, ferrying people from the suburbs to the cities, to the big airports. That is going to be really, shall I say, taking off. I mean, we see a level of maturity in that business. We'll start to see a lot of autonomy. In fact, we should be autonomous by then in the air. From our side, we'd love to see autonomy on the ground, moving our containers from the vertiport to its first or last mile destination. So I'd say within 10 years, we're going to really see this thing, the business of urban air mobility in flight. That's very exciting. I think we'll see that within 3 to 4 years, quite frankly. But it'll really be maturing by 2030, 2032. 2040, you know, we're going to be a $1 trillion industry worldwide. We're going to see more, what I would say, less air taxi service and more autonomy for individual and personal air mobility by 2040. But, you know, big aircraft moving cargo, you know, are still going to be a thing.
How's a city going to be different? Let's take that another 10 years on that. Let's make it 2050. What's a city going to be like the Jetsons? You know, I'm sure you get the Jetson question all the time, right?
The minute we start getting an energetic solution that can, you know, that is safe and reliable, that can move individuals to and from waypoints, you're going to see a lot of traffic that's platooned between cities, airports, and suburbs. So it'll be very Jetson-esque because they won't be controlling anything, right? We'll just be in a caravan of vehicles that is translating from point A to point B. Yeah, so that is a certainty. It's a fact. We'll have a vehicle-to-vehicle communication system where my vehicle talks to your vehicle and you're like, hey, I'm 25 feet behind you. Great. Stay away from me. This is our sequence and separation requirement. You know, there'll be a lot of, I'd say a whole new level of economic performance, right? Because we'll be able to expand, you know, the economy because we can do more with less time.
What's the speed that one of these would have?
So they range. I mean, like I said, our vehicle probably, it can go as fast as 250 miles an hour with the right payload on it that's aerodynamic. But, you know, we take a container, and we're going to be doing 100 to 125 miles an hour. Nothing earth shattering. Some of these other vehicles will go as fast as, we're targeting around 150 being sort of the industry objective. But I think we're going to be in the 100 to 125 miles an hour range.
So you have air vehicles, these urban air vehicles at 150 miles per hour platooning through the air. You're probably alleviating some of the traffic on the ground. So some of the traffic that's on the ground is now going to move to the air. You could also platoon in special lanes on the ground, maybe at 100 miles per hour. So how do you see the balance? And let's look at this fully autonomous world of 2050. This balance of platooning vehicles on the ground at 100, things that can go through the air at 150, the cost is probably going to be different. Timing is different, too, because you can go from point to point where if you're on a highway at 150, eventually you got to get to a city, and then you'd probably slow down. How do you see the balance, or how do you see all these pieces coming together in this future world?
It's really going to be using this intelligent, you know, digital infrastructure that's going to outline the routes that you can fly in. And if there is traffic on that route, then you're going to have a sequence and separation protocol to manage traffic. And there'll be a lot more harmony because you'll have the option of going from air to ground mobility based on what the best value proposition is going to be. It may be that it's a bad weather day and we might need to operate mostly on the ground because of bad weather. But having the option, I think, is what this is really about. You know, lightening the load on the road is going to be the key objective. Going emission-free, getting some of that carbon out of the air. But having the option of driving or flying is truly going to make the country more productive.
It's almost like you're going to need a three-dimensional Waze. And depending on what you want, lowest cost, least amount of time, best sustainability, least impact, you could pick what you want. Are you thinking about that? Do you think there's people out there working on the 3D ways of the future?
100%. It's already being done. Well, it's just another transportation option. If you look at your mobile app, you know, you can do walk, bike, drive. Another option will be fly.
Right. And it'll be a straight line from A to B.
It may be a straight line, you know, depending on, there may be a, you know, an airspace issue. You know, there may be a fire that's clouding the air, if you will, and putting debris into the air. So they may need to reroute traffic. But it's all about that option. It's a transportation option, and we're going to have it. It's coming.
John, thank you so much for giving us this. Well, first of all, for the whole definition of what urban air vehicles are, how your company fits into that and this vision into the future.
Well, Ed, I appreciate the opportunity to share it with you and your audience, and I'm looking forward to continuing the progress and looking forward to the future.
All right. So our final little segment we call Rapid Fire, a series of quick questions and answers. You can answer one-liners. You can say pass if you don't want to answer it. What was the first car you ever bought or owned?
The first vehicle I ever owned was a kind of pass. It was an Acura Integra. It was a gift.
Okay.
Great car.
Did you pass your driver's test on the first try?
Of course.
First trip you ever took in an airplane?
Well, the first trip I've ever taken in an airplane, I believe, was to Florida.
We always ask people on Future Car Podcast about if you had your living room on wheels, an autonomous car, five-hour ride. I'm going to slightly change it for you. Your pod, five-hour trip on your pod. What would you have in your pod for that five-hour trip? It's autonomous. You can do anything you want. What would you put in it?
Well, I would have a recliner. so I could recline and get a nap in. I would have a cooler to keep my beverages cool.
What's your favorite beverage you'd have?
Well, I mean, it would just be like cold water, you know, an iced tea. I would have an espresso maker, maybe, you know, just some storage for some snacks, right? A 5-hour trip might need to land for a bathroom break.
Can have a toilet in there too, if you want.
I mean, conceivably you could, if the container was large enough.
So what person living today or from the past, anyone from the past, would you want to spend that 5-hour ride with?
Well, I would say my wife, but I don't know. She might not agree with me on that one.
Good answer in case she's listening.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's like, who am I going to spend 5 hours in the car with? I mean, I do trips with some of my team members, obviously, to do business deals and stuff like that. So, yeah, I would say my wife or my team.
If you could uninvent one thing, what would it be? Uninvent.
A lot of regulation.
Okay. That sounds good. If you could magically invent one thing, what would it be?
Less regulation.
All right. Favorite aircraft of all time? Besides yours. Can't be the Sigma 6. Favorite aircraft of all time?
Well, I used to own a Mooney. That was a great airplane. I loved my Cirrus. The Pilatus PC-12 is a great airplane. One of my all-time favorites, I would say. You know, F-35 is pretty sweet.
Favorite pilot of all time? Of all the pilots that have done, brought us to where we are in the world of aviation, who do you admire the most? Your favorite?
Well, I'd have to say, as our friend that landed that United aircraft on the Hudson, it's escaping me right now. Sully Sullenberger.
Sully. Yes. Good choice. Excellent choice. Last question. Tell us something about yourself that would surprise your friends and family. Something they don't know.
Well, I think I'm pretty outgoing, and I pretty much let everybody know where I stand. But I think that what people probably don't really appreciate is the fact that I do all this because I want to help people, and I want to improve the quality of life for people. And I'm very passionate about sharing this experience and sharing this mode of transportation with people, because I sacrifice a lot personally for it. And there are a lot of times people say, why do you do this? Why do you put yourself through that? And it's because someone has to do it. If someone doesn't make that commitment to improving life for people, it's why live life? What's the purpose? You know, and so that's what I think.
John, thank you so much. Thank you for joining us and for taking the time with us.
Pleasure. Edward, thank you so much. And looking forward to our next chat.